Okay, great. So welcome, everyone. This is the Parsha class. I'm going to be filling in for Rabbi Robinson this week. This week's Parsha is Parshas Shelach. It's a packed Parsha, a lot of stuff that goes on in this week's Parsha. What we're going to be learning about is actually something that happens at the very end of the Parsha. The majority of the Parsha discusses the story of the Jewish people going, they're about to enter the land of Israel. And against the advice of God and the advice of Moshe, the Jewish people insist on sending spies into the land of Israel. The spies seem to get the wrong impression of the land, and their report causes the entire Jewish people to rebel against God, to rebel against Moshe, to cry, and because of that, they were punished and forced to wander the desert for 40 years. At the very end of the Parsha, though, there is a section which talks about a mitzvah, a commandment, which ostensibly does not have much to do with the rest of the parsha. The mitzvah is the mitzvah of tzitzis, that when you have a four-cornered garment, you're supposed to put strings on it. And at face value, that has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the parsha. There is one thing, though, about the mitzvah of tzitzis, which is very much connected to the rest of the story in this week's parsha of the spies. And that is the mitzvah of tzitzis, even though it's about clothing, the goal of tzitzis is to notice it, to see it. The language of the pasuk and the verse in the Torah, which we say in Shema, is uri'isem oso, that you're supposed to see the strings of the tzitzis. And the error of the spies, the Torah says, was that they saw the land with an evil eye. They saw it with a negative perspective. And so even though they didn't lie in their report, they nevertheless had a biased perspective and a skewed perspective when they transmitted what they had seen to the Jewish people. So I'd like to zero in on one aspect of tzitzis, which in the last, I don't know, I'd say about 100 years or so, has been an issue of debate, and that is techeles. Techeles is a blue dye, which we are commanded to dye one string on each of the four corners. We're supposed to dye it blue. And for hundreds and honestly almost thousands of years, it's been lost. We don't know exactly which animal was used to produce the blue dye. And therefore, we basically just ended up using only white strings. About 100 years ago, maybe a drop before that, 120 years ago, one of the Hasidic rabbis in Europe went to Italy and, based on some research, believed that they had been able to locate which animal was used to create the dye. I believe it was a type of squid. And he wrote a whole book about it. Then Rabbi Herzog, who subsequently became the chief rabbi of Israel, he wrote his doctoral dissertation disproving why it could not be this creature. In the last few decades, there's been another movement which believes that they have found what the correct animal is. I believe it's called the Murex trunculus. It's a type of snail. And when you take the dye and you expose it to the sunlight, it turns a deep blue. And so many people have begun adopting the practice of wearing treles, of wearing a blue string on their tzitzis. And others say that since we lost the tradition, we shouldn't do it. But it's a very peculiar commandment. Like, okay, I can understand that we're supposed to have a reminder for ourselves to remember God, to remember the commandments. And so we're supposed to have strings, something we can see when we walk. But why specifically a blue string? And as it turns out, I believe that the way the sages explain the significance of the blue highlights a tremendous evolution of Judaism that took place during the Second Temple period. a certain theological and perhaps more significantly cultural evolution that happened during the time of the Second Temple that continues on to this very day. So I'm going to share the source sheet with you. Give me one moment here. Here we go. So the title is The Old Man Above the Sea. So it's not the book that that Hemingway wrote, but it has to do with the ocean, and it has to do with people being above the sea. So this excerpt that I have in source number one, it's a quotation. It's an excerpt from a piece that was written on the Petil Techelet website, which is a organization. It's based in Israel that advocates the use of Techeles dye, of blue string, and you can buy Techeles through them. So they talk about why there's a mitzvah to have a blue string. So they say that Techeles gains its religious significance by virtue of its color association with sapphire visions. The Talmud explains what that is. It's a Gemara in Sota, and it quotes Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir asked, why particularly Techeles from among all other colored materials? Why specifically does the string that wraps around the tzitzis, is it supposed to be blue? And he answers, because Techeles is similar to the sea, and the sea is similar to the sky, and the sky is similar to the Holy Throne. And then it brings an interesting verse. It says, and they saw the God of Israel. This is talking about when the Jewish people were standing by the mountain of Sinai, when they got the Torah, and they saw God. And under God's feet, there was a likeness of a pavement of sapphire. It was a sapphire like brick or footstool, like the very sky. Another verse from Yechezkel, Ezekiel, in appearance like a sapphire stone was the semblance of a throne. So for some reason, God's heavenly throne is associated with sapphire. And presumably, the Talmud seems to say that it comes from the fact that the sky is blue. That because the sky is blue, we generally envision God's throne, God's heavenly throne, as being made of or resting upon sapphire or something, some precious blue stone. So the Talmud says that the reason why tzitzis are supposed to have a blue string is because when we look at the string, we're supposed to see blue and think of the ocean, which will remind us of the sky, which will remind us of the heavenly throne, which will then presumably remind us of God. And Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan says that in his book on Jewish meditation, he says that what the Talmud was saying, it's not just this like cognitive association, but it's actually meant to be a type of meditation. Now, the Talmud doesn't say that. This is Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan sort of extrapolating and using this in the 21st century, that we're supposed to meditate on this, that it's not supposed to just be some casual association, but rather it's supposed to trigger some very deep contemplation. Now, the Talmud doesn't say that. And what's very possible is that in the days of the Talmud, this came somewhat naturally to people. So I'll just scroll up and you can see I have four different squares here. One is blue, one is the ocean, one is the sky, and then one is I don't know if you could call it like a lawn chair or some type of chair resting on the cloud, which is supposed to symbolize God's throne. So when I was in rabbinical school, they wanted us to take an EQ test. It's an emotional intelligence test. I believe it's called the Mesquite, if I'm not mistaken. And it was supposed to identify different areas of emotional intelligence to be able to utilize that when we do pastoral counseling and whatnot. And one of the questions on the test was, what kind of emotions speak to you when you see certain colors? So red was supposed to be anger, yellow might have been sadness, green might have been life, various different associations to colors. So when we think of blue, I don't know, maybe some of us think of the sea. It might be true. And then when we think of the sea, many of us may think of the sky. And when we think of the sky, maybe some of us might think about God and or God's throne. But that's not necessarily the natural tendency of people. At least I can speak for myself. Maybe all of you are much more spiritually sensitive than I am, and that might be the case. But at least for myself, when I see the color blue, my knee-jerk reaction is not to think about God. It's to think about, I don't know, something blue. But it doesn't naturally lead me to to think about God's heavenly throne. Maybe it's because I haven't memorized the verses in Ezekiel that talk about this sapphire throne of God, but that's just not my reality. And in fact, Rabbi Ari Kaplan says that nowadays we need to have this almost as like a meditation type of thing, that it doesn't come naturally. We need to train ourselves to think that way. But in the times of the Talmud, and especially before the Talmud's time, when the Jews were in the desert, when the Jews first got into the land of Israel, that was the natural inclination of people, that when you saw the color blue, blue was a very rare color in nature. That's why it was considered a color of royalty, blue and purple. There aren't so many blue things in the natural world, with the exception of the ocean and the sky. And so when you thought about blue, you instinctively thought about the ocean and you instinctively thought about the sky. And when you think about the sky, you instinctively think about God and God's heavenly throne. And this sort of mindset, I believe, evolved over history, which may explain why for us it's not as natural. And in fact, the Talmud itself grapples with this, I guess, sort of cultural evolution that occurred between the first and the second temple. This is not a course on the history of the second temple, but to summarize it, there were many crucial differences between the first and second temple Judaism. The primary one was the blossoming of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, of the oral law. As Orthodox Jews, we believe that the oral law was given to us at Sinai and it developed over time. But the written record that we have of it and the explosion of rabbinic literature that we have was non-existent during the time of the first temple. It was just transmitted from one prophet to another, from one sage to another, and there really wasn't much literary development. There wasn't much creativity. The bulk of what we have, the bulk of the literature that we have nowadays comes from the Second Temple era, and actually towards the end of the Second Temple era. The Mishnah was really only started. The very earliest sages that are mentioned were from the beginning of the Second Temple period of time. And so by definition, all of the literature that we have only came from that time and onward. But there were also some other critical differences. One of the other critical differences, and it's connected, was that there was no longer any prophecy. According to Jewish tradition, there were several prophets that came with the Jews from Babylon back to Israel. Mordechai may have been there, Ezra, Nehemiah, and then probably the most famous ones that are included in Tanakh, in the Bible, are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those were the last of the three prophets for Israel. And after they passed away, there was no longer any prophecy. And 99% of the time that the Second Temple was around and onward, there was no history, there was no prophecy anymore. Another interesting difference, which the Talmud actually, which rabbinic literature links to those previous two, was that there was no longer any insatiable drive to worship idols. If you've ever studied the Sifrei Nevi'im, the books of the prophets, especially the later ones, and honestly, many of the earlier ones also, the prophets bemoan and berate the Jews for worshiping idols. And that was certainly the case. In many archaeological expeditions, we've found idols in areas where Jews lived in the land of Israel, dating from the First Temple period. However, during the Second Temple period, there was not a drive like there was beforehand to worship idols. And certainly nowadays, you can debate whether Christianity or Islam might constitute idolatry, but there was no drive for paganism during the Second Temple period and beyond. There was no drive to worship idols. And the Talmud grapples with how we could look up to so many great people in the Bible, and yet so many of them erred with paganism. And for us, there's absolutely no tava. There's no desire to do that. So let me learn a Gemara with you. And it talks about this. You know, there's a picture on the screen now, if you can see it, where you see the golden calf, and then you see a bunch of modern looking dressed people bowing, genuflecting, worshiping it. And it seems ridiculous because nowadays, the modern 21st century person does not see any logic or has no desire to bow down to a statue of a cow. And yet, the Jewish people in the desert, who were some of the most holy, special people, who literally saw God and saw all the miracles of God taking them out of Egypt, nevertheless bowed down to this cow, this calf. How could that be? And so there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin which kind of reflects this question. It tells a story of Rav Ashi, who was one of the authors of the Talmud, one of the later sages in the Talmud. And he was lecturing, he was giving a shiur on Tanakh. He was giving a shiur about Menashe, one of the worst kings in Jewish history, who was responsible for the proliferation of idolatry. And he made fun of Menashe. He made fun of him, saying that he's not such a great person. So the Talmud says that Menashe came to him in a dream and basically criticized him for saying that you can't speak disrespectfully to me because I am so much more knowledgeable in Torah than you are. And he asked Rav Ashi a question and basically proved that he knew things that Rav Ashi didn't. And so Rav Ashi asked him, he says, and this is in the bottom box over here, Amar Le, Rav Ashi said to King Menashe in his dream, Me'acher dechakimaso kulehai. If you are so wise, my taima kapalichto la'avodas kochavim. What is the reason that you engage in idolatry? If you're so wise, doesn't mean that you're so righteous. If you're so wise and you're so smart, how could you fall into this trap? It makes no sense. So Amarle, so Menashe said back to him in this dream, Ihavis hasam havanaktina bishipule glima viriata abasrai. You would have lifted the hem of your cloak and run after me to this house of idols due to the fierce desire to engage in its worship. And Rav Ashi accepted that answer and then began to speak about Menashe with respect. What that basically means is that Menashe was telling Rav Ashi, you cannot understand the culture and sociology of the Jewish people in the first temple. You cannot relate to it. You cannot understand it. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos which says that you should not judge a person unless you've reached their space or unless you've walked a mile in their shoes. And the reason why that's the case is because you just can't understand where they're coming from. So you can't appreciate how they could make so many mistakes. And that's what Menashe was telling Rav Ashi. You cannot understand. You cannot appreciate the intense desire or need to worship idols because you did not live in that cultural reality. And Rav Ashi accepted that. But the Gemara doesn't explain what that reality is. The Gemara here does not explain what that cultural reality is. There's another Gemara which begins to shed light on what that difference is. Before we get to that Gemara, there is a very early Medrash. It was probably written in, I don't know, probably the 300s, probably around the time of the year 300, shortly after the Mishnah. And it's called Seder Olam Rabba. It's one of the earliest, with the exception of the Mishnah, it's one of the earliest works of rabbinic literature. And what it basically does is that it constructs a timeline using verses from Tanakh, from the Bible. And it intersperses it with various teachings about Jewish history and Medrash. And so it quotes a verse from the book of Daniel, the book of Daniel, and it refers to, and it basically interprets one of the verses in Daniel's vision about referring to Alexander the Great, or Alexander from Macedon, as the Medrash calls him. And that took place at the very beginning of the Second Temple period. And then it editorializes the verse by adding in a seemingly unrelated fact, which is, Ad kan payu hanavia misnabim beruach hakodesh, mikan ve'elech hat aznecha v'shama divrei chachamim. Until the time that Alexander of Macedon came to Jerusalem, there were prophets prophesizing with the Holy Spirit. There were prophets in the land of Israel. Once Alexander of Macedon entered Israel, once he conquered the land of Israel, prophecy stopped. And the only source of divine knowledge that we have are the sages, are the rabbis. So this was a very self-serving medrash. The rabbis were basically saying, now that there's no longer any prophecy, you need to listen to us. There are no prophets. There's no one else to listen to. Now, it's very weird because the book of Daniel never says that when Alexander of Macedon will come to the land of Israel, prophecy will stop. There's no record in the actual Tanakh or in the actual Talmud that links the cessation of prophecy to the coming of Alexander of Macedon. But according to this medrash, which again was written in the year probably 300, there is a link between prophecy stopping and the meeting of Hellenism and Greek culture. Leo Strauss famously wrote about Athens and Jerusalem. And so it would seem that this meeting of Athens and Jerusalem resulted in prophecy disappearing from the world. That was the inevitable consequence of the meeting of Athens and Jerusalem. And the Vilna Gaon, one of the greatest Torah authorities in the last few hundred years, he wrote a commentary to virtually every work of rabbinic literature. And so in his commentary over here, he references a Gemara. He references a piece in the Talmud that says that the arrival of Alexander of Macedon actually coincided with another event, which the Talmud does link with the cessation of prophecy. And that was when the sages slew the evil inclination, when the sages killed the Yetzer Hara. What does that mean? It's a fascinating story. This is a Gemara in Yoma. For those that are doing Daf Yomi, it'll be coming up in, probably about a week and a half. Probably about 2 weeks, actually. And the Gemara tells a story. It's interpreting a verse from the book of Nehemiah, which takes place when the Jewish people were first building the second temple. And there were many Jews that had actually seen the first temple. It was only a 70-year period of time. And so there were many Jews that had grown up when the first temple was around that had seen its destruction, that had lived through the exile, and now coming back as very old people were rebuilding the second one. And it says that they cried out. And they cried out because they said, the first temple was destroyed because of idolatry. And yet we see that there are Jews that are still worshiping idols. So what's the point of building the second temple if it'll just be destroyed again? There's no point. It's a futile endeavor. And they said, we don't want it. We don't want to worship idols. We don't want to have this desire to worship idols. And we don't want the reward for refraining to doing so. We've proven, humanity and the Jewish people in particular have proven that they cannot coexist with this desire to worship idols. And so a note, it said, fell from heaven, which was written with one word. It had the word truth. God is a God of truth. And by God communicating that to the people, it showed that God agreed with their analysis, that it was better to not have this desire to worship idolatry. So the sages fasted for 3 days and three nights, and God delivered the evil inclination to them. It came out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It came out from the Holy of Holies in the form of a fiery lion cub. And Zechariah, who was the prophet at the time, said to the Jewish people, this is the evil inclination for idolatry. So they caught hold of it. They grabbed it. And one of its hairs fell out, right? A lion cub has tons of fur. And so one little hair fell off and it let out a shriek of pain that was heard for miles around. And they said, what should we do? How should we kill this? If we try to just physically kill it, God will have mercy. God may have mercy on this evil inclination because it's crying out in so much pain. So the prophet Zechariah said, throw it into a container made of lead, seal it, and the lead will absorb the sound. And in that way, you'll be able to kill it without it arousing the mercy of heaven. And that's what they did. Then, in the aftermath, they said, since we see that this is working out, that God's listening to us, let's do the same thing for the evil inclination for forbidden sexual relationships. So they prayed, they did the same thing over again, and God gave it to them. But Zechariah said, this is not a good idea. You can't kill this evil inclination, because if you do, no one will have a desire to procreate, and humanity will just die out. So they followed his warning, and instead of killing it, they imprisoned the evil inclination for forbidden sexual relationships for 3 days, and they searched throughout the entire land of Israel, and they couldn't find a fresh chicken egg. What that meant was that not even the animals had any desire to procreate. And they said, what should we do? If we kill it, the world will be destroyed, because no one will reproduce. We can't pray for half of it to go away, because God doesn't do that. God doesn't work in halves. It's either all or nothing. So what should they do? They gouged out his eyes and basically attenuated or diluted the power. And so because of that, nobody has desire anymore for certain types of forbidden sexual relationships, those with close relatives. That's what the Talmud says. It's a bizarre story, and I certainly believe it's not meant to be taken literally, that they didn't grab hold of the evil inclination. But what that meant, but the imagery is very stark. There are a number of questions we can ask, but one of the most glaring is that the evil inclination seems to be very much related to Kedusha, to holiness. Because where was this evil inclination? The Talmud said that it came out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, of the Holy of Holies. And when they tried to kill it, they were afraid that God wouldn't let them, because it was crying out in pain. And God would have mercy on the very root of evil, which makes no sense, because God said, you're right, you should kill it. And yet, nevertheless, they were concerned that God would have mercy on it. So what exactly is the evil inclination? So there's a fascinating Medrash Rabbah. The Medrash Rabbah, which was written, this was the Bereishis Rabbah, so it's one of the earlier Midrashim, probably written in really the 500s, maybe the 600s, which was when the Talmud was written. It interprets a verse from Parshas Bereishis, the very beginning of Genesis, at the end of the creation story. It says that God looked around and saw that everything that he had made was very good. So in all the other days, it said that God saw that that what he had created was good. But when you see everything in its totality after the whole creation process is done, then it became very good. So the word very seems to add something, that something that was there now was not there before. God seems to have created something else when all of creation fits in together. So what is that? So the Medrash says, Tov me'od ze yetzer hara. Very good refers to the evil inclination. So the Medrash asks, V'chi yetzer hara tov ma'od, is the evil inclination good? Ella, she'ilule yetzer hara, without the evil inclination, lo bana adam bayis, a person would not build a house, v'lo nasa isha, they wouldn't get married, v'lo holid, they wouldn't have children, v'lo nasa v'nasan, and they wouldn't conduct business. What this Medrash Rabbah is teaching us is that the evil inclination is not like this picture shows, some person with cloven hooves and a pitchfork and horns that's red and standing on your shoulder whispering to you to do bad things. The evil inclination refers to the innate drive in humanity to grow, to build things, to create a legacy, to build a house, to build a family, to build a business. Those are all drives that we have. They're neither good nor bad. They're neutral. We can harness them for good things, and we can harness them for bad things. And so when we talk about that the Jewish people during the time of the first temple had a desire to worship idols, it wasn't that they had something on their shoulder that was whispering for them to worship idols, and eventually they managed to kill it. No, what it meant was that there was this innate drive that in order to fulfill their biological and psychological need to create a legacy, to create a family, to create a business, to create a house, to create a civilization, all of these things are the factors that drive a society. People, labor, arts, culture, infrastructure, all of those things are embedded in the psyche and the needs of humanity. And the drive for idolatry meant that the only way that humanity felt that they could do that, that they could realize all these goals, was to embrace this transcendental power of something, this mysterious force that was greater than themselves, that was greater than their world, than their environment. Because back then, we didn't know much about how to control the environment. We didn't know how to control our world as well as we do nowadays. And so you could look to God, you could look to Hashem, or if you wanted an easier or perhaps more attractive way to do that, you could look to sticks, stones, gold, silver. You could create an idol of your own, and that would fulfill that need and give you whatever the psychological or sociological reassurance that you would need to carry out all of these goals. And so they told God, we can't handle this anymore. Humanity needs to change. We can't feel this fear and this intense drive to look to the supernatural. We just can't do that anymore, because when we do, we naturally, instead of gravitating to God, we gravitate to false idols. And God agreed to that. But there was a cost. Because God didn't just take away somebody on our shoulder. God changed, or God facilitated a change of the way humanity worked. And as we'll see in sources number 7 and 8, the Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Rev Eliyahu Dessler, who quotes Rev Tzadok HaKohen. Rev Tzadok HaKohen was a very interesting figure in the late 1800s. He grew up as a non-Hasidic Jew in Eastern Europe and then became a Hasidic Jew, but actually worked in Central Europe. So he interfaced with the more modern Jews, if you will, of Germany. I think he also spent some time in France. So he was a rather cosmopolitan figure and developed his own sort of genre of Jewish philosophy, sort of weaving together Talmud, Kabbalah, philosophy, a lot of interesting things. And he basically said that all of these three factors, Alexander the Great, the killing of the evil inclination for prophecy, the killing of the evil inclination for idolatry, and the cessation of prophecy, that trifecta, are all linked together. And it all happened, it was all facilitated by the interaction of the Jewish people with Western Greek culture and Hellenism. So the Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Rev Eliyahu Dessler, he summarizes Rav Tzadok. So we'll look at that first, just because he puts it in a lot more simple language, a lot more concise language. He says that we find in the words of Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin that as long as the evil instinct of idolatry existed, there was prophecy to counterbalance it, and there were visible miracles in Israel. For God creates forces to oppose one another. That's a verse from Mishle, from Proverbs. What that means is that there is always a balance between the powers of holiness and impurity. The reason for that is because if there would be an imbalance, let's say there would be, it would be much easier to serve God, then there wouldn't really be free choice. We would just naturally serve God. And the flip side is also true. If it was so hard to serve God, then we wouldn't have any free choice. We would just be doing the wrong thing because we were forced to. So God always keeps the forces. I don't want to say good and evil, because that's not really how he saw it. But God keeps the forces of Kedusha, of holiness, and non-holiness equal. So as long as there was prophecy in the world, what was prophecy? Prophecy was a sensory and visceral faith. Religion was not as legalistic. It was a very intimate feeling between humanity and the infinite and the divine. There were miracles, there were prophets, you could talk to God. So to counterbalance that, there were also visceral forces facilitating the credibility of idolatry. There was this desire to worship idols so that free choice would be preserved. We also see that in the early days of the Second Temple, the desire for idolatry was destroyed, as the Talmud said. And conversely, because of that, because there was no longer that great need to worship idols, and we'll see what that need is in a moment, we had to lose prophecy because otherwise we would just naturally be drawn to God and we wouldn't have free choice. And that's why the sages didn't want to do it until God approved it, because we would be losing something so special. By destroying the desire to worship idols, we were also relinquishing our very intimate visceral connection to the divine. That's why the desire for idolatry came out of the Holy of Holies, because it was a byproduct of having a very intense relationship with the infinite, with things that were beyond this world, with the spiritual. In the times of the First Temple, if you saw the color blue, you automatically thought about the ocean, you automatically thought about the sky, and when you saw the sky, you automatically thought about God. Or if you were not a good person, you automatically thought of an idol. That was what we lost. And when did we lose it? The Vilna Gaon said, based on that Seder Olam, we lost it when Alexander the Great came. That was how God facilitated it. God just didn't like erase a gene from humanity, this like psychological gene that made us predisposed to worshiping idols. No, there was a historical cultural development that happened. So if you see these two pictures, the one on the left is based on a Gemara also in Yoma. We're not going to have time to do it right now, but it depicts Alexander the Great kneeling before Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik, if you've learned Pirkei Avos, was one of the vestiges of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola was the earliest group of Mishnaic rabbis, of sages from the Mishnah, that built the Second Temple, and there were prophets among them. And after that, prophecy ceased. When those people died out, prophecy ceased, and the oral law that we have began to take shape. So one of those people in that transition time period was Shimon HaTzadik, who was also the high priest, who went into that Holy of Holies. The Talmud says that when Alexander the Great came, he realized that this person, Shimon HaTzadik, was actually somebody that appeared in his visions before he went to battle and always assured him of his success. And so he bowed down to Shimon HaTzadik and said that he would not destroy the temple, he would not just capture Jerusalem, rather the Jews and the Macedonian Empire would coexist in peace. And to commemorate that event, the Kohanim, the priests, named their children Alexander. And Alexander is a Jewish name to this very day. What that symbolized was that there was a merging of Greek Hellenistic culture at the time of this transition period. If you look on the right, you see Alexander the Great listening to Aristotle, his tutor, in Greek philosophy. So when Alexander kneeled before Shimon HaTzadik, he was saying that Greek philosophy and Greek culture will kneel before Judaism, but it won't go away. They'll coexist. And that coexistence facilitated a change in Judaism. So Rav Tzadok HaKohen, now we'll see this piece. Rav Tzadok HaKohen wrote a book called Sichas Malachei Ashares, which literally means Speech of Angels, which is a really cool title. At the end, in an appendix, he mentions this event, this historical meeting between Alexander the Great and Aristotle, and then subsequently Alexander the Great and Shimon HaTzadik. So I'll read it in English. He says, Aristotle, who was the greatest of the sages of the nations of the world in secular wisdom, was a contemporary of Shimon HaTzadik, who was the greatest of the sages of truth, the sages of the Mishnah and the oral law. For God created opposing forces, all of the sages of the nations of the world before Aristotle and Greek philosophers had their wisdom rooted in the supernatural. What that means is that by and large, until Greek philosophy really took over, any type of natural science has always had magic or supernatural elements woven into it. If you've ever read translations of Egyptian medical works from ancient Egypt, you'll see that there was this blend of natural science and magic and religion. That began to change with the advent of Greek philosophy. And he continues, and the sages of Greece began to establish the wisdom of science and the study of nature of things, though they only attributed it to the laws of nature. Now, again, I don't know how expert Rav Tzadok HaKohen was with Aristotelian metaphysics or Platonic metaphysics. I can't speak to that. I don't know. I'm not an expert. But certainly, Rav Tzadok is correct that Greek philosophy really got the ball rolling at that time of taking out the supernatural out of science, taking the supernatural out of learning how to understand the world. The wisdom of the sages, however, is to see the natural world and to see that God controls and rules over that and uses angels who are the spiritual forces of nature. And the experience of prophecy, the vision of heaven opening up when a prophet communicates with God, facilitated a visceral knowledge of God and his glory filling the world. But this was lost with the advent of science and oral law. What Rav Tzadok argues is that all these three things are connected. When the Jewish people decided that they couldn't live with the mindset of having this insatiable drive of looking to the supernatural world to understand the world because that just led them to idolatry, God said, okay, we'll change it. The first thing in it that to facilitate that change will be this interaction between Hellenism, Greek philosophy, Greek science, and Judaism. That way, when you want the crops to grow, you'll think about rain and how rain works. You'll understand mathematics and geometry and learn about how all the various natural forces in the world work. And you won't be automatically drawn to idols. But there's a cost to that as well. And that cost was that the way we lost our desire for idolatry was that we began to see less and less of the supernatural in the world. Now, supernatural doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means that it can't be explained by the laws of nature. What that means is that we began to see less and less of God overtly in the natural world. And that was a sad thing. We lost prophecy because of that. We were not able to perceive God as intimately as we did beforehand. And because of that, Judaism underwent a change, Rav Tzadok says. The oral law, human initiative, the vast majority of the Mishnah and the Talmud, all of that is humanity using our own intellect and logic to interpret the Bible. Now, we believe that God gave us the tools to interpret that Bible. God said, I'm giving you the tools to do this, and now you have to figure it out. But what that basically means is that humanity began to assume a greater degree of control over Judaism. It became much more legalistic in nature. Now, again, we don't have the opportunity to go into detail about what changed and what was the same. Just a little plug, if any of you are interested, that will be a bit of what we will be discussing this coming Sunday evening in the class on Rambam's introduction to Mishnah. So this coming week, we'll be talking about what was given at Sinai, what began to be developed by sages later on in history. But regardless, Rav Tzadok says that Judaism fundamentally changed both religiously as well as culturally between the First and Second Temple period of Judaism. And if we want a more modern perspective on that, Rav Soloveitchik in Lonely Man of Faith, as well as in Uvikashta Misham and his work, And From There You Shall Seek, in both of those books, he talks about this. For those of you who are familiar, that is the dichotomy of Adam 1 and Adam 2. So Adam 1 is a certain archetype of humanity that God created. God embedded in humanity the biological predisposition as well as divine mandate, to control the world and to live a dignified life of self-sufficiency. So it says that the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, said, "Man of old, who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitude to yellow fever or plague with degrading helplessness, could not lay claim to humanity. Only the people who could build hospitals, develop medicine, and save lives, that is when humanity began to develop dignity. Civilized man has gained limited control of nature and has become in certain respects her master. And with his mastery, he has attained dignity as well. In doing this, humanity is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted to us by God." And he finishes up by saying, "It is a manifestation of obedience, controlling nature, trying to advance society." And it doesn't mean only with medicine, but with all areas of science, of social science, of mathematics, of humanities, of culture. All of that development is good to live a dignified life, to be able to control our lives amidst all of the vicissitudes that nature throws at us, whether it be a pandemic or a natural disaster. The more we invent and develop to control that, the greater a dignified life we can live, and the greater degree of Selem Elohim, of being in the image of God, we embody. However, Rav Soloveitchik says, that came as a cost. That advent, the descendants of Greek science and Greek philosophy, it came at a cost. He says, modern science has emerged victorious from its encounter with nature because it has sacrificed qualitative metaphysical speculation for the sake of a fundamental duplication of reality. It's a very fancy way of saying that we're not interested in the why, we're interested in the what. We're interested in how the world works and what it means and what it means to control nature. And we don't stop and think often of why the world is that way. It doesn't mean that we don't believe in God. But it means that when we look at the sea and we look at the sky and we look at the color blue, we don't think about the divine. We think about harnessing the power of water. We think about wavelengths that create the color blue. We think about going to the beach. We think about having fun in the water. We think about providing clean water for people that live in impoverished countries and can't afford that and can't afford to purify water. We think of ways to deal with that, to address those needs. But we don't always think to the divine. And he puts it very beautifully. He says that Adam the second, the one that does think about the divine, the one who has a different way of looking at the world, looks for the image of God not in the mathematical formula or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, and the stillness of a starlit evening. In a word, this type of human explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the fascinating world where we can establish an intimate relationship with God. Now, these are not two different people. Rav Soloveitchik says that these are two different signs of what it means to be a human being. And throughout our lives, we balance each of those. We're in constant balancing act, trying to figure out when to exercise Adam 1 of being able to control the world, and Adam 2 of being able to be inspired by the world, to be able to connect and see God in the world. And it's a constant balancing act. And that comes, Rav Tzadok said, that came from the development of Judaism from the first temple to the second temple, when we got rid of the desire for idolatry by praying to God to change that, and God bringing in Alexander the Great, bringing in Greek culture, Greek philosophy, Greek science, where we took out the supernatural from the natural world. But once that happened, inevitably, we lost prophecy. We lost that intimate connection with God. And it's not that we can't achieve it. We just have to work a whole lot harder. It doesn't mean that we can't be inspired by a beautiful evening. It doesn't mean we can't see God in science. We can't see God in nature. We can, and we do. And that's what we teach our children. That's what we teach ourselves. In fact, there's a song that was written in 1986 by Avram Fried, where he says, "You don't have to understand it. Just feel it in the air. See it in the old man's gentle smile. We don't have to see God because we all know that he's there. We hear it in the mountains echo and the ocean's roar. We see it in the rolling clouds above. Even though it's been said 10,000 times before, we know Hashem is the world. It's Hashem we love." And I think it really captures what I'm trying to bring out from Rav Tzadok, which is, and Rav Soloveitchik, which is that there's this certain feeling that we have that we can be inspired by the natural world. We can be inspired by God. But it's a little bit harder. We've heard it 10,000 times before. And it's something that we can't really understand. It's something that we feel. But it's hard to cultivate that. It's hard for that to come naturally, to be able to, when we see the color blue, naturally think about God's throne. And the reason is because we have evolved. We prayed to God that we should evolve as a civilization by divorcing the supernatural from the natural, because when they were merged, we couldn't handle it. And God agreed with us, and God facilitated that transition. And ultimately, we've been the better for it. Even though the temple, the second temple was destroyed, God said, "I promise you there will be a third one, and that one will never be destroyed." Moreover, Torah has blossomed since that point. We have an oral Torah that is infinite. And to this very day, the world of Torah, the world of halacha, the world of Jewish philosophy continues to grow and develop. And you can argue, and Rav Tzadok does, that was a positive thing. That this separation between the natural and the supernatural and making it more difficult to achieve an intimate connection with God on an emotional, cultural level, ultimately, while there was a cost to it, will ultimately be a good investment because it resulted in a growth of Torah. And when we do see God in the natural world, that connection is so much more powerful because of the time and effort that it took to develop that connection. The distance that God created between us, that God developed between us, when we bridge that gap, when we see God in the natural world, when we see God in science, when we see God in humanities, that makes the bond all the more greater. But it's still not as easy as it was back then. So that's what I think the ultimate idea that we can take away from Tzitzis, and especially the blue string of Techeles, is. That right now, the Talmud says that the blue string has been hidden from us. We think we know what it is, but we're not 100% sure. And I believe that the reason is because the Techeles, that blue string, symbolizes that intimate connection with seeing the supernatural and connecting to that in the natural world, which we don't have since the temple was destroyed. Since the second temple was even built, we lost that over time in history because of this natural development and evolution of society, which we prayed for and which God granted us. But ultimately, the Talmud says that we will, at one point in history, when Mashiach comes, we will refind this chilazon, this animal that gives us the blue dye. Maybe we have it now, maybe somehow we'll confirm it. But the Talmud says that ultimately we will get that back. We will get back that tradition. And it also says that we will get back prophecy. But it doesn't say that we will lose all of the science, all of the humanities, all of the advancement, and all of the Torah that we've developed and that was an outgrowth of that separation. What that basically means is that humanity will grow and will have the best of both worlds. When Mashiach comes, when we ultimately go back to the land of Israel and the sin of the spies is wiped away, when we're able to use our eyes to see in the natural world, to see the supernatural, to see God in our everyday lives, then we will have the best of both worlds. We will have both all of the benefits of a evolved, developed, dignified human civilization. And at the same time, we will also have this very intimate connection with God. And I just want to close that. I think we've kind of felt this very poignantly during the pandemic, at least I did. We've seen the fragility of humanity. And as the vaccine continues to be prove successful, we've seen humanity triumph. Now, that shouldn't minimize the tremendous loss of life and the pain and the sadness that's happened because of the pandemic. But as a civilization, as a world, we are beginning to conquer another aspect of nature that has harmed us and has impeded us from living a dignified life, from being able to walk outside, to go to work, to be with our friends or family. And yet, when we get that vaccine, now that we have that scientific knowledge, there is an even greater responsibility on humanity to develop spiritually as well. Because Mashiach will only come when the spiritual development and the scientifics, cultural, and civilization development equal out. We continue to grow exponentially as a civilization with scientific and cultural advancements. But with that, we must begin to see God in our everyday lives as well, to see God in science, to see God in the world. So I want to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos. When you sit down at the Shabbos table, or if you ever read the Chumash, whether it'll be in shul or at home, to take a few seconds just to think about how we can see God in our everyday lives and in the advancements that we've had as a people and as individuals. So I want to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, and I hope to see you all soon. Take care.